You are listening to The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. Episode 11, The People's Defense. Здравствуйте, товарищи. Hello, comrades. Over the course of the final week of August 1917, the career courses of General Lavr Kornilov and Prime Minister Alexander Kerensky finally collided, and the general attempted to overthrow the provisional government, destroy the Soviets, impose iron discipline in the ranks of the army and the proletariat, and reinvigorate the war effort against Germany. If we were to draw parallels between Paris 1871 and Petrograd 1917, what we would have here would be the bloody week of the Russian Revolution. Except, as we will see by the end of today, it only would have been, but it was not. Exactly how and why the Russian proletariat managed to avoid the fate of the Paris Communards will be clear by the end of today's episode. But I'll warn you now, folks, this one is dense. So much happens over the course of just a handful of days, and the nature of the coup attempt really is one of the devil is in the details. The coup wasn't even really supposed to be a coup at the outset. So just keep in mind that we're going to be tracing a lot of zigs and several zags before we come out on the other side today. After the Moscow Conference, the right wing and economic elites began to speak openly in favor of Germany winning the war. We're going to have to breeze past this, but a German offensive on the Eastern Front of Europe managed to capture Riga, the capital of Latvia, on the 21st of August. This put the German army less than 600 kilometers from Petrograd. That's about 350 miles for us Yankees. In the wake of this news, the landowner Mikhail Rodzianka, he of the early days of the February Revolution, published a piece in the newspaper Utra Rossii, or Russian Morning, pining for the Germans to finally take Petrograd and crush the Soviets. John Reed, an American reporter who was in Russia for most of 1917, met with a group of businessmen for tea at the home of a Moscow merchant, and was surprised to learn that by a margin of 10 to 1, those present preferred a German victory to a Bolshevik one. This again highlights the class nature of the revolution. Lenin and the Bolsheviks were proponents of revolutionary defeatism and desired the defeat of the Russian army in order to further the cause of the revolution and emancipate the Russian people, and eventually all of Europe, from the yoke of the landowners, aristocracy, and bourgeoisie. The ruling classes, however, espoused a kind of reactionary defeatism. That is, they desired the defeat of the Russian army in order to crush the revolution and the popular movements they themselves were too weak to put down, in order to reassert their own dominance. Lenin and the Bolsheviks are always smeared as German agents and traitors to the motherland, but that's different from the elites wishing openly the Germans would finally just show up and slaughter Russian workers and peasants because, yeah. Anyway, Kornilov had slowly begun to move troops into position around Petrograd and other cities even before the Moscow Conference. But after the conference, the general began to prepare them for direct movement into the cities. Some of his crack units included the 1st Don Cossack Division, the Ussuriski Mounted Division, and the ominously nicknamed Savage Division, which was comprised of soldiers from the Caucasus Mountains known for ferocity and savagery in battle. Trotsky quotes Kornilov as saying to General Lukomsky, quote, "It is time to hang the German henchmen and spies with Lenin at their head, and to disband the Soviet of workers' and soldiers' deputies, and to disband it in such a way that it does not meet again anywhere else." End quote. But of course, the general was not acting alone from his headquarters far from the capital. Inside Petrograd, the rightist organizations, the main committee of the Union of Officers, and the Military League, began drawing up plans to incite riots, which would then be used as a pretext for Kerensky to order troops into the capital and declare martial law. The plans included publishing inflammatory articles in the rightist press in the lead-up to the six-month commemoration of the February Revolution on the 27th of August, as well as sending people to pose as Bolsheviks and try to whip up the workers into striking and rioting, Tactics, it must be noted, that are still in use by right-wing governments around the world today. It also appears that, if none of this worked in provoking violence on the streets of Petrograd, there were plans to simply commit the violence themselves. Basically, they were desperate for any reason at all to declare martial law so that Kornilov could crush the Soviets. As for Kornilov and Kerensky, while they were distrustful of each other, they were also, at this point, earnestly attempting to work together. But each was trying to maneuver to subordinate the other to himself. Kornilov appears to have held out hopes that Kerensky would do the right thing and declare martial law, at which point he would be allowed to keep his post, but then be subordinated to the military. As for Kerensky, he watched the troop movements and heard whispers of the planned provocations in Petrograd and was relieved that it appeared that soon the Bolshevik menace and the workers' movement would finally be put down. But at the same time, he could not help wonder if Kornilov was simply going to do away with civilian government and Kerensky altogether. But okay, this is where we start to get into the details of that last week of August. On the 23rd, the deputy minister of war, a man named Savinkov, worked diligently to actually shore up the relationship between Kornilov and Kerensky, and set the stage for what he and others hoped would finally be the end of the madness of the revolution. Meeting with Kornilov at army headquarters, which the Russians called Stavka, at Mogilyov, Savinkov and Kornilov made a series of agreements regarding proclamations the general expected the government to make to formalize the military taking control. They also discussed the general taking direct command over the troops in the Petrograd military district, minus the troops actually located in the capital, of course. Even Kerensky knew that Kornilov being handed direct command of the troops that watched over the government while it slept would be giving the general too much power all at once. The meeting between the deputy war minister and the commander-in-chief ended amicably, and the general again pledged his loyalty to the government. The meeting did much to assuage Kornilov's concerns that Kerensky would not have what it takes to help him establish a strong national government that would deal with the Soviets, the workers, and those damn socialists who are mucking up the war. In fact, maybe Kerensky would prove to be a useful political figurehead after all. For his part, Savinkov was very satisfied with how his meeting with the commander-in-chief had gone. Perhaps naive to the real balance of power between the army and the government, he left Mogilyov on the 24th, eager to report back to Kerensky. In preparing for his triumphant march into Petrograd, Kornilov ordered General Krymov to move into the city upon receiving reports of a Bolshevik uprising that were to be expected in just a day or two. Krymov, in turn, drafted a decree for a strict martial law that would be put into effect once the capital was taken, with several extreme provisions, including a curfew, the forced disarming of workers, and orders to shoot anyone found to be in violation of the decree. On the 26th, both Generals Krymov and Klimbovsky were to begin moving their troops on Petrograd from the south and north, respectively. Plans to stage a putsch on the 27th were still in the works by military officers inside Petrograd itself, and it seemed in a matter of days the entire affair would be a done deal. But at the exact same time the military was preparing for its glorious victory against the workers and peasants, a total monkey wrench was being thrown right into the middle of everything. Nobody, least of all Kornilov and Savinkov, had any idea that anything was amiss until only a few days later, when the actions of a complete and total rando derailed any hopes of a collaboration between the government and the military. Who was responsible for this bungling bolt out of the blue? One Vladimir Nikolaevich Lvov, no relation to the former Prime Minister Georgi Yevgenievich Lvov, who had resigned in July. Alexander Rabinovich describes this new Lvov as a, quote, well-meaning, though naive and muddle-headed busybody, end quote. He had the political credibility of having served in the 3rd and 4th Dumas, as well as the clout that comes from having connections with business, industrial, and agrarian interests in Moscow. According to Rabinovich, Lvov believed that Kerensky and Kornilov must work together for the peaceful establishment of a national government, and became alarmed when he began hearing rumors of a military coup being prepared by Kornilov. But the actions Lvov undertook to try to avoid any split between the government and the military served as the direct catalyst for that exact outcome. On the 22nd, the day before Savinkov and Kornilov met at Mogilyov, Lvov took it upon himself to travel from Moscow to Petrograd to meet with Kerensky in person and see what he could do to, help. At this meeting, Lvov told Kerensky he was worried about the strength of the government and offered to help determine how much support there was for a unified national government. However, Lvov presented himself as representing, quote, certain powerful interests, a phrase that was needlessly cryptic. Lvov meant his rather benign connections in Moscow, and appears to have meant exactly what he said. He wanted to gauge support for the government, likely assuming that it would be much higher among the elites than it actually was. But Kerensky, already worried about certain powerful interests working against the government, assumed Lvov meant, well, certain powerful interests working against the government. So he decided to use Lvov and his offer not to sound out support for his government, but to smoke out any threats to it. Now carrying Kerensky's blessing, Lvov left Petrograd. He first stopped back in Moscow and started telling his connections there that Kerensky was indeed amenable to a national cabinet, and that Kerensky might even, get this, be willing to resign if necessary. Where he got this idea is anybody's guess, because the possibility of Kerensky resigning never even came up in their meeting. After sowing plenty of disinformation, he then hopped on a train to Mogilyov, arriving the 24th. The day Savinkov left Mogilyov for Petrograd, convinced he had just buttoned up an alliance between the military and the government. Lvov, however, was completely ignorant of the agreements Savinkov had made with Kornilov on behalf of Kerensky. Lvov met with the general that evening and asked what the commander's attitude would be toward an entirely new governmental cabinet, to which Kornilov gave a vague and non-committal response. But later, Kornilov and his generals agreed that Lvov's arrival meant that Kerensky was, in fact, weak and amenable to a compromise. From their viewpoint, Savinkov had just left that morning, and now, a few hours later, here's this new guy saying he's representing the interests of Kerensky, but talking about forming a new government, and asking for Kornilov's input, which Kornilov took to mean, not entirely unreasonably, that he could name ministers as he saw fit. The next day, the 25th, Lvov and Kornilov met again, and this time Kornilov was much more forceful, demanding supreme civil and military authority and insisting that Kerensky come to him on the 27th at Mogilyov for his own protection. Lvov, for his part, seemed to accept the demands without question and boarded a train to go back to Petrograd to, dutifully report back to the Prime Minister. Back in the Winter Palace, Kerensky was absolutely shocked to learn of Kornilov's demands. At first, he thought Lvov was joking, but when he realized the man was serious, the Prime Minister insisted on communicating with Kornilov via teleprinter in order to hear it from the general himself. And if you're wondering like I was what a teleprinter is, it was basically the cutting edge of communication technology at the time. You could type out a message on one teleprinter, transmit it, and then the teleprinter at the other end of the line would print it out in real time. Basically, it was texting in the early 20th century. That's right, on the eve of establishing a military dictatorship, the commander-in-chief and the prime minister, the two most important figures in the country, decided to finalize their plans over text. But since Kerensky did not have an iPhone, he and Lvov agreed to meet at the War Ministry, where the teleprinter connected to Mogilyov was located. Their meeting was set for 8:30 that night. 8:30 rolled around, and Kerensky was there, but Lvov was running late. At this point, Kerensky was so agitated that he decided to start the conversation with Kornilov without waiting. However, so that Kornilov would not suspect anything was amiss, Kerensky lied and said that Lvov was there with him. Kerensky, posing as Lvov, sought confirmation of everything Lvov had relayed to him earlier that day, including the general's request that Kerensky, along with Savinkov, join him in Mogilyov. When Kornilov confirmed this, Kerensky insisted he could not leave Petrograd any sooner than the following day. Kornilov agreed, but insisted in turn that Kerensky not delay any longer than that. Kerensky promised, and the conversation ended. After this exchange, the military leaders must have been jubilant. The head of the civilian government seemed about ready to submit to their takeover without a fight. There was even talk of only needing Kerensky for a few weeks after the takeover, after which he could be discarded. Whether that meant he would be forced to resign, arrested, or killed, we don't know. But either way, pretty brazen talk. Kerensky, on the other hand, was now convinced that turning himself over to the military would end his political career, and more likely, his life. But he had gotten himself into a pickle. He and his government had been colluding with the military to crush the Soviets and the socialist parties, not least of all the Bolsheviks. Admitting this fact would surely trigger another uprising in the capital, except this one would not be a pretense. It would be real, and likely even more dangerous than the uprising in July. I think the phrase here is, play stupid games, win stupid prizes. So Kerensky instead decided to replace Kornilov as commander-in-chief as quickly as possible. He had Lvov arrested, and interrupted a cabinet meeting at which the government was discussing Savinkov's meeting with Kornilov to read his own conversation with the general to the ministers present as proof of the general's treachery. Kerensky demanded immediate powers to deal with the threat. The cabinet, with the exception of a couple of cadets who sided with Kornilov, supported the prime minister. They all resigned on the spot, either in protest or in support, in order to allow Kerensky to create a new government however he saw fit. Yes, on the eve of a planned military coup to overthrow the government voluntarily dissolved itself, concentrating all its authority into the one minister who had not resigned, Kerensky. At this point, we are in the early hours of the morning of the 27th. Kerensky fired off a telegram to Mogilyov, relieving Kornilov of his command. The telegram was received by General Lukovsky, whom Kerensky intended to name as Kornilov's replacement. But Lukovsky wired back almost immediately, declining the post and insisting it was too late to sack Kornilov, and that events had been put in motion that could not be stopped. This forced Kerensky to go to Plan B, start issuing orders to Kornilov's troops to fall back to their original posts, orders that were ignored. When that failed, Kerensky was forced to go with Plan C. Go public with the whole affair, in the hopes of being saved by the very people he had planned to destroy. He, of course, crafted the narrative to cast himself in the best possible light. He explained that Kornilov had sent Lvov to him to demand the government yield its authority to the general, and announced publicly that he was firing Kornilov and putting Petrograd under martial law. When Kornilov got wind of this public declaration, he absolutely and completely lost it. From Kornilov's perspective, Kerensky was the one double-crossing him. And to be fair, it's easy to see why he came to this conclusion. Kerensky had first sent Savinkov, a deal had been made, and then he had sent Lvov to ask the general for input on forming a new government. Kornilov, assuming that Kerensky, Lvov, and Savinkov were all playing the same game on the same team, had merely been responding to messages he was receiving from the government. And now Kerensky was sacking him and declaring him a traitor? In response to Kerensky's public declaration, Kornilov had an open letter drafted and sent to all military commanders, in which he vehemently denied the accusations of treason. He accused the government of collaborating with the Bolsheviks, quote, in full agreement with the plans of the German General Staff, end quote, and insisted his only goal was saving Mother Russia and winning the war with Germany. He officially countermanded the order from Kerensky for his troops to stand down, instead ordering they continue their movements toward Petrograd. Mogilyov was flooded with messages from top generals declaring their loyalty and support for Kornilov. And at this precise moment, the general mood in the military, in Petrograd, and all over the country was that in just a day or two, Kerensky would be no more. Kornilov would be established as the new leader of Russia, and after crushing the socialist left, the full might of Russia would be turned back toward the goal of defeating Germany. In anticipation of this outcome, the stock market soared as economic elites everywhere expected that war profiteering would return, making them all very rich. Well, richer, anyway. But, there was one factor in all this for which the generals and officers and economic elites did not properly account. It was as if they had simply forgotten just how often in the last 6 months the working masses of Petrograd had demonstrated their willingness and ability to organize and work as a cohesive unit to pursue their interests and defend their gains. They all thought the left was done for in the face of the might of Kornilov's forces. But after the break, we will see just how wrong they were. If you are enjoying this show, and you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. I have been thinking of how best to show my appreciation for my supporters, and I have a few different ideas in the works. Early access on Patreon, without mid-show plugs like this, is definitely coming soon. But that's not all. Once we get past the revolutionary period and the Civil War, there will be polling to help me figure out what subjects you want me to cover. I even have an ambitious plan to bring the voices of still-living Soviet citizens to the show. I haven't quite worked everything out yet, but I am very excited at this and a few other ideas. So please, head over to patreon.com/sovietpod to support the show. Also, please leave a rating and review on whatever platform you are using. And please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. Now, back to the show. By the 26th, the workers and soldiers of Petrograd had caught on that the next day, on the six-month commemoration of the revolution, the pretext of public disorders on the streets of the capital would be used to declare martial law. This prompted the Petrosoviet and nearly every single workers' union and factory committee in the city to declare publicly and loudly they were not calling for demonstrations of any kind whatsoever. The Bolsheviks specifically warned that dark figures were attempting to provoke disorders in the name of the Bolshevik Party, and that these calls were not to be heeded. On the 27th, after Kerensky had gone public, reports started coming in detailing the rift between the Prime Minister and the Commander-in-Chief, and in their new headquarters in the Smolny Institute, the Executive Committee of the Petrosoviet met the evening of the 27th well into the morning of the 28th to discuss the situation and decide what to do. The debates at Smolny went back and forth. Just about the only thing they could agree on initially was that Kornilov had to be stopped. But what about Kerensky? Should he be supported as the lesser evil? Or should the Soviets try to take advantage of the rift between the government and the armed forces to do away with them both? Could they even pull that off? And if they were to support Kerensky, what kind of support should they lend? Kerensky seemed intent on creating a directory-style government, modeled after the directory that ruled France during the Great French Revolution of the 1790s after the fall of Robespierre. That is, Kerensky wanted a committee comprised of just a handful of individuals that would exercise supreme political authority. But just like in France, Kerensky's directory would almost certainly be fiercely counter-revolutionary. During a break in the sessions, a few messengers were sent to Kerensky to inform him that there seemed to be forming a consensus that the Soviet would support Kerensky, but only if he formed a new coalition only with the socialist parties, the SRs, Mensheviks, and Bolsheviks, and only if a second state conference was called with this new coalition. Kerensky, however, was insistent that a six-person directory be created now to deal with the immediate threat of the troops moving on Petrograd. This news was received with disdain at Smolny, and even provoked a call from some in the Bolshevik faction for the immediate creation of a Soviet government. As the pre-dawn hours of the morning of the 28th gave way to the dawn hours, the Soviet Executive Committee began receiving more concrete reports of the full extent of the military threat they now faced. Reports of Kornilov's troops moving on the capital from multiple fronts seemed to shock the Soviet deputies enough that they realized there was actually very little time for political debate, and that they had to pick a side. So, of course, they sided with Kerensky. The Menshevik Tseretelli put forth a resolution pledging the full support of the Soviet to Kerensky, sanctioning whatever measures he deemed necessary for fighting off Kornilov's coup. This time, the danger was perceived as so immediate that even the Bolsheviks joined the resolution with barely any objection. With this crucial decision made, the Soviets finally leapt into action. The Executive Committee began issuing its own set of commands and instructions. These orders were sent to workers' and soldiers' committees in Soviets, the Petrograd garrison, and key infrastructure posts such as the telegraph and railway. They warned of the impending threat to the revolution, and instructed that commands and orders from Stavka were to be ignored, while commands and orders from the All-Russian Soviet Executive Committee and the provisional government of Kerensky were to be carried out immediately and fully. Troops under the command of Kornilov and his generals were to be watched closely. Their progress was to be impeded and their communications disrupted as much as possible. Finally, the Executive Committee announced the formation of a new Committee for the Struggle Against Counter-Revolution, to be manned by 3 socialist revolutionaries, 3 Mensheviks, and 3 Bolsheviks. But at this point, there was one question everyone was asking. Would the Bolsheviks join this effort? Everyone understood that the entire defense effort rested on the answer. The only way to stop Kornilov would be to mobilize the masses of workers and soldiers, and as we have seen in recent episodes, the Bolsheviks had taken a commanding role in organizing these elements of society. This meant that the only chance the government and the Soviets had of defeating Kornilov lay with the party they had tried so hard to crush just weeks prior. Ratcheting up the tension, the Bolsheviks did not provide an answer right away. They debated in various meetings of the Petersburg Committee, the Central Committee, and Factory and Workshop Committees. There were 2 lines of thinking. One was that the Bolsheviks must not work with the compromising SR and Mensheviks, and must not lend its support to Kerensky. These Bolsheviks believed they should let Kornilov and Kerensky defeat and exhaust each other, and then perhaps the workers could sweep aside the victor and seize power via the Soviets. But this line was held by a very small minority of party members. The overwhelming majority of Bolsheviks held to the second line. They understood the reality of the situation. If they did nothing, Kornilov would crush Kerensky and the compromising socialist parties, and then immediately turn on the Bolsheviks and their constituents among the workers and soldiers, and that would be the end of it. The party thus recognized there was only one way out of this. They must join forces with the provisional government and the other socialist parties. Kerensky and the Soviets breathed a sigh of relief at the announcement that the Bolsheviks would join the defense effort. Now that everyone was on the same page, Petrograd and the surrounding area became an absolute whirlwind of activity. An exhaustive accounting of every single organization, group, committee, union, and faction that joined the struggle against Kornilov and what they each did would be impossible, and impossibly confusing. If you really want such an account, Rabinovich provides it in his chapter on the defeat of Kornilov. But be warned, you will need a photographic memory to have any hope of retaining all the information presented. The main point I want to make here is that, once the Bolsheviks joined the fight, And once the workers and soldiers of the capital and surrounding areas were told about the danger posed by Kornilov and how little time there was to act, almost as one, they took every conceivable measure to defeat the uprising. This included workers, men and women, digging trenches and erecting barricades on all approaches to the city. Workers securing food supplies in the event of a prolonged siege, increasing security around factories, and forming volunteer battalions to patrol the streets and fight the invading troops. Soldiers providing on-the-spot training to these workers in how to handle firearms. Patrols keeping tabs on the army officers in the capital who had been planning provocations and either keeping an eye on them or arresting them. Post, telegraph, and typesetter workers refusing to pass on messages between Kornilov, his generals, and his allies in the capital, while working overtime to facilitate communications for the defense of the revolution. And unions across the board pledging whatever resources they had, including money, supplies, and personnel, to the defense of the capital, the Soviets, and the revolution. While the efforts of all these individual unions played their own important roles in beating back the counter-revolutionary insurgency, if there was one union which deserves a special mention, it is undoubtedly the All-Russian Executive Committee of Railway Workers, known by its Russian acronym, Vikzhel. The railways were, of course, the arteries of the entire nation, and as such, the role played by the workers controlling these arteries in literally stopping Kornilov's plan in its tracks cannot be overstated. Vikzhel received and immediately carried out orders to hinder troop movements by any and all means necessary, including diverting trains away from the capital, delaying delivery of supplies, abandoning their posts, and blocking and tearing up rail lines for miles well beyond the city limits, which meant that if Kornilov's soldiers wanted to enter Petrograd, they would have to do so on foot. Railway workers also took on reconnaissance for the capital, reporting troop movements the entire time. For nearly 4 days, since the public was made aware of the counter-revolutionary threat until that threat had evaporated, and we will get to that in just a moment, the workers of Petrograd and the surrounding areas were in non-stop crisis mode, and the solidarity and unity they displayed is worthy of the highest praise. However, an honest, sober account of the Kornilov forces arrayed against them at the time would indicate that, had it come down to it, the fighting would have been fierce and bloody to be sure, but the capital could hardly have been expected to hold out against the army for long. Which is why we see, once again, just like in February, the role of the rank-and-file soldiers and sailors was critical and decisive. This time, though, it wasn't just the soldiers stationed in Petrograd. The sailors at the naval base on the island fortress of Kronstadt formed a military technical committee to assume full control of the military resources of the island, and pledge those resources to the defense of Petrograd. In Helsingfors, present-day Helsinki in Finland, which was at the time part of the Russian Empire, workers and soldiers Soviets mobilized against officers suspected of plotting with Kornilov. In Vyborg, a Russian city on the border with Finland, similar measures were taken. In both instances, officers sympathetic to Kornilov or who refused to recognize the authority of the Soviets were arrested or executed. Bloody, yes, but the total number of individuals thus dealt with counted less than 100, whereas the bloodshed these officers were in favor of would have seen hundreds of thousands dead, not to mention continued participation in the meat grinder of World War I. So far, we have talked about all the ways in which vast sections of society mobilized in response to an external threat. Now it is time for the mobilized forces of the revolutionary proletariat and soldiery to come face to face with this threat. It is a testament to the power of the masses that the Kornilov coup, launched on the 27th, was, by the 31st, completely nullified, because as the generals' forces moved on Petrograd, the soldiers and workers of the capital talked to the men who made up those forces. As early as the 28th, trains were forced to a standstill along destroyed rail lines. Soldiers were disembarking, and officers were finding it impossible to send or receive any messages due to the stranglehold on communication the workers held. It was at this time that groups of soldiers and workers from the capital and the towns along the way, places like Narva, Jamburg, and Luga, began approaching and imploring the soldiers under Kornilov's command not to do what they were being ordered to do. They explained that they had been lied to, misled, and were being used to put down not an external threat of German agents trying to destroy the motherland, but to wipe out the revolution, undo all the gains of the previous 6 months, and install a military dictator. The Kornilov troops, for their part, turned out simply to be following orders. The rank-and-file soldier did not really understand what had been happening in Petrograd and with Kerensky. He only knew what his officers had told him, that Kerensky was in league with the Bolshevik German agents, and the fate of the motherland depended on removing him and crushing the traitorous Bolsheviks. But when scores of their fellow countrymen and comrades in arms approached and scolded them for their actions, explained what was actually happening, and implored them to join their side, well, they did. They had no loyalty to a general who was vowing to crush the revolution and throw them all back into the fray of war. By the 30th, the Yusuriski Mounted Division, the 1st Don Cossack Division, even the vaunted Savage Division, as well as the majority of the other divisions and regiments that Kornilov had mobilized against Petrograd, had all hoisted red flags, arrested their commanders, pledged loyalty to Kerensky and the provisional government, and formed revolutionary committees to spread the word to their fellow troops currently moving on the capital that they were, in fact, being used by the counter-revolution and not against it. As for the higher-level officers and commanders, including General Krymov, who had been traveling with the 1st Don Cossack Division, they quickly realized that their plot had been foiled. It was not just that the railways had all been wrecked miles and miles outside the capital, keeping them from their goals. It was not just that their communications were being jammed by the workers whose movement they had vowed to crush. It was that the armed people of Russia, the revolutionary proletariat and soldiery in and around Petrograd, with their physical and armed presence, made any attempts at further advancing impossible. With their own troops deserting and defecting, all that was left was an isolated group of officers with pretensions of power, but no actual power. The fate of General Krymov is a sad example of the dejection now felt by the military officers who had taken part in the Kornilov Affair, as the Soviets later came to call it. Krymov, after losing control of most of his troops, took a car into Petrograd, arriving the night of the 30th to the 31st. The city was as calm as if nothing had ever happened. The morning of the 31st, Krymov was subjected to questioning and harangues from Kerensky. Krymov insisted he had only ever wanted to maintain order, but Kerensky knew better. He threw Krymov's own words back in his face in the form of his order laying out the implementation of military rule after overthrowing the government. Rabinowitz writes that Krymov, who had zero respect or love for Kerensky, could not endure this wounding of his ego and military pride. Krymov was dismissed from Kerensky's office in the Winter Palace mid-afternoon with orders to appear for still more questioning at the Admiralty later that day. The Lieutenant General, realizing that from here on the only thing waiting for him was being stripped of his military command and prosecuted and imprisoned for treason, instead went to a friend's apartment and shot himself in the heart. Oh, and as for Lvov, who had been arrested and sidelined on the 27th, on the 30th, he wrote a note to Kerensky, which Rabinowitz includes in his book. Quote, "My dear Alexander Fyodorovich, from the bottom of my heart, I congratulate you, and I'm happy that I delivered a friend from Kornilov's clutches. Yours always and everywhere, V. Lvov." End quote. Nice job, buddy. Couldn't have done it without you. Before we wrap this up, I want to check in with our good friend, Lenin. Since he was still in hiding, he had been unable to have much direct influence on the events discussed today. But that did not mean he had nothing to say about them. As he did with every major event in the course of the revolution, Lenin wrote copiously about the Kornilov Affair. Of all his writings the last week of August, the one I want to highlight here is a letter to the Bolshevik Central Committee, in which he lays out what the strategy of the Bolsheviks should be in this moment, and what working with the government, the SRs, and the Mensheviks means, and what it does not mean. He, of course, recognizes the need to work with the government to stop Kornilov, but at the same time warns against being unprincipled and falling to opportunism. Lenin insists that the Bolsheviks refrain from openly supporting Kerensky and the other parties, and that by working with them to defeat Kornilov, they must encourage the masses to recognize how weak Kerensky was at this moment, how his own bumbling had provoked the crisis. He also called for the continuation of political demands of the dissolution of the Duma, transfer of the land to the peasants, the establishment of control over the means of production by the proletariat, the release of still imprisoned Bolsheviks, and an end to the war. Now, in the end, the letter holds only theoretical value, not practical. It was written on the 30th, based on newspaper reports. Lenin acknowledges in the letter the high probability that the situation would have changed by the time it was received, considering how quickly events were unfolding. So this is not a case of Lenin issuing orders from the underground and the Bolsheviks falling in line. By the time the letter was received on the 2nd of September, the crisis was completely over. The fact of the matter is, Lenin did not really have anything to do with the defeat of Kornilov, but his constant vigil against falling into the trap of opportunism does constitute his most important contribution to this particular moment in the revolution. He insisted the Bolsheviks must not allow themselves to be subordinated to the government, but instead make a temporary alliance while maintaining their overall independence from and hostile attitude toward Kerensky, the Mensheviks, and the SRs. It was a fine line Lenin was insisting everyone walk, but it was, in the end, the correct line. The overwhelming defeat of Kornilov, coming as it did 6 months to the day after the overthrow of the Tsar, stands, in my mind, as one of the proudest moments of the entire revolutionary period, second only to the October Revolution. It was perhaps the clearest example in the entire revolutionary year of 1917 of the saying, "United we stand, divided we fall." And it was a near-perfect example of just how much power the masses could wield. The fervor and commitment which poured forth from the working masses of Russia in response to a threat to their interests is simply inspirational. What is most impressive is the spontaneity with which the masses operated. There was simply no time for the Bolsheviks or the other parties or even the government to deliberate and debate and argue about theory and tactics. There was not even time for these groups to form a coherent plan of defense and to issue orders and coordinate actions. Instead, the Bolsheviks, as the main representatives of the workers in the capital, put a call out to action, and the workers responded. The breadth of their spontaneous organization and the collaboration between workers in industry, service, communications, and transportation, with soldiers both in and around the capital, provides a textbook example of the power the masses can wield when they work together. They faced down the might of some of the top generals in the Russian army, and they did so almost without bloodshed. They reminded everyone, those same generals not least of all, just who operates the trains, sends the telegrams, connects the phone calls, guards the supplies, runs the industrial machines. That is, who really controls the levers of actual power in society. But in celebrating the ability of the masses to spontaneously organize themselves to counteract a grave threat, we must keep in mind that just because the Bolsheviks as a party did not command the defense of the capital in a centralized, organized fashion, that does not mean that the vanguard party was unimportant or superfluous. It was the Bolshevik rank and file that led the counterattack against Kornilov and emerged victorious. It was precisely because there existed at that time a mass party of workers which had spent the last 6 months cultivating the trust of the proletariat and soldiers, who had proven time and again that the party was the best vehicle for them to realize their own potential and secure their demands, that the workers were united enough to act in such a decisive manner. Absent the Bolshevik party, if they had been decisively defeated in the wake of the July days, or even if they had succumbed to opportunism and were indistinguishable from the Mensheviks and SRs in their collaboration with the bourgeoisie. Personally, I am as certain as I can be about a counterfactual that the Russian Revolution would have ended right here, that Kornilov would have swept away the provisional government and the Soviets and established, at least for a time, the military dictatorship he sought. Without the Bolsheviks as a party, as a vehicle for organization, and as a stark contrast to the collaboration with the bourgeoisie of the other parties, the mass mobilization that defeated Kornilov simply would not have been possible. Thank you so much for listening. All translations from the Russian text are provided by me, unless otherwise noted. Any errors or inaccuracies are therefore my own. If you are enjoying this show, and if you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. Any amount helps and is greatly appreciated. This entire project is run only by me in my spare time, and in practicing my anti-capitalist values, I will never run ads. So regular contributions allow me to devote more time, energy, and resources to making the show the best it can be. Please also leave a review and rating on whichever podcast platform you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. If you'd like to get in touch, you can write me at sovietpod@gmail.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. До свидания.